Mama Pajama rolled out of bed and she went to the police station. Papa found out, he began to shout and started the investigation. It was against the law. It was against the law. What your mama saw, it was against the law. Mama looked down and spit on the ground every time my name gets mentioned. Papa said, oh, if I got that boy, I'm gonna stick him in the house of detention. But I know no way. I don't know where I'm going, and I'm on my way. I'm taking my time, but I don't know where. Goodbye, Rosie, the queen of Corona. See me and Julia down by the schoolyard. See me and Julia down by the schoolyard. Okay, finally got it to work. Didn't work at first. Hello, folks. The Queen of Corona, indeed. How have they not renamed that park? Corona Park, just sitting there in the middle of fucking Queens. And they never renamed the beer either. Another thing I can't kind of get my head around. But they both seem like that would have been no-brainers. I guess you just don't want to admit what's really happening. Corona Heights in San Francisco. There we go. I got to say, someone says the new Snyder movie. Very excited for the new Zack Snyder zombie movie because Dawn of the Dead is probably his best film. And that opening sequence is really the best. It is the best. It's the closest any zombie movie has gotten to what I have always wanted in a zombie movie and never got, which is the actual moment, the dramatization of the moment when the zombie crisis hits normality and disrupts it. And there is they tried it in the book World War Z does a great job of that. But the movie has just one stupid, terrible scene where a bunch of guys are running around in Philadelphia. Otherwise, very lame. But that opening sequence, when it's the fucking suburban Waukesha County cul-de-sac just going to hell, it's tasty. Of course, they couldn't sustain it because the rules of the game and also what's cheap to film don't really allow for that kind of thing. But I'm looking forward to it. The fact that they digitally replaced Chris D'Elia with Tig Notaro like a year after the movie was made is pretty funny. So that'll be funny to see. And also, I'm interested to see how they get the incredibly stupid premise of bank heist during a zombie apocalypse, because a lot of people say, what are you going to do with the money? My presumption is that it's a contained zombie situation. The zombies like took over Las Vegas, but there's also now like a return civilization. But you got to figure post-zombie apocalypse that they would at least revalue the dinar. You know, put out some new sort of currency. Bitcoin, maybe. Okay, so one bit of business before I start what I want to talk about today, and that is that for next week, I'm going to read the first three chapters of Kolb's Weimar Republic. I'm not sure. We might just read that and be done with it because it's, from what I understand, one of the best best like capsule treatments of the German Revolution. So we'll read that, and we'll go from there. I kind of have an idea that I want to read a Kim Stanley Robinson book because a lot of what I'm going to be talking about and what I've been focusing on in my mind lately is confronting the reality of living, trying to live and trying to articulate a political subjectivity at a time of full despair. And I do think that there is a way that despair can be grappled with and transcended. And I'm trying to help, I'm trying to do it for myself. And I'm finding like by the day I am able to do it, you know, and that's all it is. It is a project. All life is that day-to-day project, that minute-by-minute project. It's not something that can be just turned on and off like a light. It's a daily struggle. But you can struggle easily or more difficultly. You know, you can be confronting the real thing, or you can be dealing with some epiphenomenon of it that you then engage with instead, and which will never allow you to get anywhere because you're not actually confronting anything. And so I wanted to maybe read something that, because, you know, the despair is why I was looking backward. The despair is why I'm looking at, you know, the Civil War and the German Revolution and thinking, like, what could have gone differently? Where is that other world that we could be living in? But that's not the only thing I want to do with it, because, you know, we all have to live now. So Kimber Stanley Robinson has been doing a very interesting job in trying to do non-doom-based, non-capitalist fantasy futurist fiction, which is very difficult because, as we'll talk about, the future now only belongs to the rich. The future has been privatized. The rich are the only people who get to imagine a future. Yes, Ministry of the Future is the one that I want to read. So we'll see about that after the Weimar thing. So if you're rich, you can imagine a future for your children. You can imagine giving them a world better than yours, because you can convince yourself the same way the mid-century modernists convince themselves about a middle-class future. They can imagine a boutique rich person future. And all the stuff that's going to happen to everybody else will be very unfortunate, but also unavoidable, inevitable, and not my problem at the end of the day. Nobody else gets to imagine a future. When we think of what's coming next, it's just a black hole. It's terror. And so that is one of the things that depoliticizes the mass of people. Because if you have no future that you can move towards realistically, then what's the point of engaging anything? Why not, as we talked about last week, just try to solve in the shortest term possible my own selfish desires? It's the only smart move in a futureless world. So confronting despair is about reclaiming the future in a lot of ways, and accepting despair, but accepting with it that you still exist and that you still have a beating heart and that something is driving it, and to find what that is and move towards it. And we can all do that. But it means disengaging from a lot of the things that we have become addicted to that have allowed us to cope without actually directly addressing. And so I think reading something that is unabashed in its willingness to imagine a human future, even though that is cringe, because my God, how can anyone take it seriously? How can anybody take it seriously? We all know we're doomed. We all know that there's no fucking hope. Look at the fucking hockey stick. Look at who has the money. Look who has the fucking technology. Look what kind of social cohesion we have or class consciousness. It's a terrifying prospect. The math doesn't hold up. But so everybody has to risk cringing. Everybody has to risk stepping off into the abyss and saying, I'm going to believe that we can do this. And so, after we do this stuff with Weimar, I want to read the Ministry of the Future by Kim Stanley Robinson. So we'll be doing that one. So to get to what I wanted to talk about today, though, and dealing with despair, is the, in my mind, uncanny resonance between the current moment. I wouldn't say decade, because I think we're beyond the point where discrete decades, at least maybe we're beyond decades, or maybe they can only be understood in further retrospect than we have now. Whatever you want to call it, this period, I would say post-2008, whatever you want to call that. It's now what? It's now 12 years, 13 years. It's a long decade, let's say. Is essentially the 1970s being recapitulated, in that it is an era of mass disillusionment from an understood system. The 1970s was the decade when America, throughout in every walk of life, not just the hippies who got disillusioned by the failure of their movement, everybody, from suburban reactionary homeowners to Haight-Ashbury burnouts, everybody got the Ned Beatty speech. Everybody got the the conversation with the man in the back of the room to tell them how things really were. Everybody got to eat a naked lunch in the 1970s because all of our illusions were no longer sustainable. Our economy, the Keynesian welfare state that we built was no longer sustainable. The social models we'd created were collapsing. Our expectation of advancement of a future better than our present, that the fucking carrot on the stick of in America's exceptionalism, has been extinguished. All of our institutions were proven to be criminal jokes. The media, politicians, you had Watergate, you had the Church Committee, you had the hangover of Vietnam. Everyone understood. And then when you combine that with just bread and butter stuff, like the real beginning of deindustrialization and the massive strike wave, that's like the very tail end of American labor militancy sort of burned off. Like the last excess energy the labor movement had burned off in a bunch of wildcat strikes in the 70s. Sort of a mirror of the burst of strike activity in the late 1940s that sort of set the stage for it was the birth of the modern business-oriented collaborationist post-war labor movement, and it began with a bunch of wildcat strikes in the late 40s, 1948, and it ended with a bunch of wildcat strikes in the 1970s. And they mostly failed. So the labor movement failed. It was awash in corruption, and it was not unable to meet the needs of its members. The institutions that employed people were already moving jobs away. Inflation and unemployment coming together in a way that no economist thought was possible. And then the church committee and the revelation that, yeah, your government was spying on you and assassinating leaders and maybe killed the president. There was a House Committee on Assassinations in the 70s that found probable cause that Kennedy was killed as a part of a conspiracy. They put it at the foot of the mob, but nobody really believed that. And of course, Watergate, the Prussian presidency, this institution that had a genuine investment in the notion of the presidency. People believed in the president in a fundamental way. Now, of course, Vietnam certainly started creating that crisis of credibility, but then Nixon's entire behavior, and then finally, of course, in office, and then of course Watergate just destroyed it. And so the systems failed. It was spiritually dead. It was corrupt and crooked, and it didn't even function anymore at providing material gains. And you had Jimmy Carter trying to put out a liberal sort of pious gloss on it, a need for America to regain spiritual. He demanded that Americans refine their non-materialist spirit at the very same moment that the credit card was being introduced in mass numbers for the first time. The very first time that Americans were asked to fucking take on debt instead of save money. Oh yeah, you got to stop being materialist, but also you need to start charging money you don't have in order to maintain the fucking consumer economy that we're replacing manufacturing with. So everything's broken down. Carter represents the very tail end of the liberal consensus when all of its bread and butter promises are gone and all that's left is its piety, is its smug morality. And of course, that's not sufficient to the moment. But what is, and I think, this should sound familiar. Like, we are in that era. The Iraq, the fucking war on terror, the economic collapse, the presidency of Trump in every direct. Like, if you're a liberal or reactionary, the elections of just the presidential elections have essentially destroyed any lingering faith you had in the system. But what this moment of disillusionment is from, it's obviously not from the thing that was destroyed in the 70s, because what happened in the 70s, and this is the distinction, between the 70s and now, this is the significant fundamental difference, is that we were trapped in this this mire, despair in the 70s. All of our systems don't work. We don't even trust ourselves anymore because we don't even know who we are. And then into this morass, into this moment where everybody has taken the red pill and pulled themselves out of the matrix and found out that they live in a mud puddle with no sun, and they're tasked now to remake the world with no tools, Ronald Reagan shows up. And this is, and presents to people a chance to get back into the matrix. The Reagan response was, hey guys, you know all this horrible stuff we know? Let's all forget about it. Let's all pretend that this didn't happen. And we're going to be able to give you your consumer spending back, your confidence back, your sense of destiny and your sense of self-possession back, because you're going to cut your taxes. This whole government model, this whole Keynesian model, we're throwing that out, and we're going to bet on you. And given the options, that's what people chose. It was right there, of course. Oh my God. What if we try this instead? What if we say it's every man for himself? And if that's the case, I'm going to get ahead. We're going to get rid of the whole notion that there's any sort of social compact. And that will allow us to forget everything, because all that stuff, that was all of the bad accumulated gunk of post-war liberalism. We can blow the fucking dirt off and start fresh. And then we have what's right about America, the good stuff. And so we built a new consumer-based economy based on that. But the thing is that it wasn't just Reagan offering this. Reagan offered it to the mass audience of like suburbanites who make up the center of gravity of American politics. That was his pitch. That was the pitch they got, was from Reagan. And it sounded great. But everybody got a pitch. Like, I've been reading recently about some of the early 70s, like, psychonaut guys, like Robert Anton Wilson and Terrence McKenna, all those, like, psychedelic dudes who hit the fucking hard edge of the failure of the 60s. And their faith in the ability of, like, the individuated consciousness of people to come together to overthrow evil. Because remember, the American like counterculture was broadly libertarian because it was middle class. It rebelled against the status quo because it restrained the individual. That's one of the big reasons it was unable to be politically effective. So the 70s saw this crisis along every axis, not just at middle America, but among the most advanced progressive elements who did not have any connection to a class project or a class consciousness. They had a desire to transcend. They wanted to skip over class because it's too hard. It's too tough in America, and because we're too isolated from it, and because it threatens our autonomy. And we really do value our autonomy. America, throughout, even our left throughout America, has been wildly suffused with our basic ideological understanding of freedom. I mean, how could it not be? Where else is it coming from? It's generated by our culture, and even at its most powerful, our working class political consciousness was enmeshed with it as well. So the dream, after the failure of the people to organize in the 60s, became, well, we will get over the bump of organizing by literally just expanding consciousness. Like John Lilly and fucking Timothy Leary, all of these dudes were like, we're just going to use our brains to like fix the sequence, get a frequency that overwhelms everything, all of our structural impediments. And of course, this is very non-dialectical and it's very non-Marxist, but that's because this is what they had. And this is what they had, their brains were by then. And even they got a deal in the 80s. Even they got an opening. that allowed them to move forward out of despair. And it was networking, cybernetics, and the internet. The California ideology. The California ideology was the defeated counterculture on the West Coast trying to get around the question of politics by creating a technological infrastructure of communication that would lead to a raising of consciousness that would literally allow us to evolve beyond the needs for these institutions that are imprisoning us. And those guys all, a lot of them ended up working with early internet pioneers and early computer research. And there's a huge overlap in computer science and that like psychedelic ideology. And here we are now, after having the internet around for 40 years, here we are now where no one can promise what Reagan promised. We can only blame others for the doom. That part he was good at, but he was also good at sketching an alternative. No one can believe in that because the neoliberal state that Reagan built and that people invested belief in and that they reconstructed and reinvested their belief in institutions like media and government around has now failed the same way that the post-war Keynesian consensus failed in the 70s. It has now failed as comprehensively and even more dramatically because the 70s really was this weird, like, frog in a pot thing. This was a collapse and then a remaking of the economy in the aftermath of the collapse that destroyed the last lingering public investment in America's like economy, home ownership. And so now you can't believe in any political alternative that's going to wipe the slate clean like Reagan promised to and give us a new thing to believe in and gives us a chance to forget. We can't forget. And then even at the margins, you cannot hope for some sort of technological, spiritual transformation because we know what that leads to. The California ideology had led to the creation of the single most effective communicator of a demiurgical, superstructural mind prison you could imagine. This, without even having to use the little nanobots, they essentially put a fucking panopticon in our own minds, forgetting what any kind of actual surveillance technology we now are subject to, which is comprehensive. We have the panopticon in our mind now. So we can't even believe in that. So we have to believe in something else. And it can't be the self because all of these things are premised on the self. And our crisis now is that we can no longer reconcile our self as we understand it with the world we're living in. And that means we have to change our perceptions of the self. And that is the hope we must fixate on, and the hope that exists and cannot be denied, is that that despair is premised on an understanding of ourselves that is that assumes as inviolable this this transactional relationship we have with our each other and the very fabric of reality. This isolation that we operate from the premise of, because it's in that context that all that disillusionment of the 70s only led to reaction, because we were disillusioned, but we were not reillusioned. We were not reillusioned around the necessity for our collaborative action. We were, in fact, only reaffirmed in the futility of collaborative action. But now there's no vent. There is no promise that can be made plausibly. And that means we're going to have to, just out of sheer survival instinct, gonna have to change. Because even our most selfish instinctive desires are now in conflict with our ability to sustain ourselves in this time. And so without any dream of transcendence, without any fantasy of reorientation of the economy coming from the structures we have, we will all, on our own timelines, be forced with a final confrontation with the box with no fucking the windowless room. We're going to find ourselves with no escape, and then we're going to have to make one instead of taking the one that's offered us. Instead of going where they hurt us, we're going to have to fucking start bashing on the walls ourselves and cutting fucking holes in where we see fit. I do not understand cybernetics. Excuse me, sir. I don't know anything about computers. I am saying one thing. There's one thing I know about computers, and it is that the promise of computers in the 70s has led to a reality that is the diametrical opposite of everything that the people who put them together claimed, I think even to themselves, they were doing. Somebody asked what Disco Demolition Night is, and I gotta say, surprise, that, I mean, I guess I shouldn't be. You guys are all kids. I don't remember this, but it's one of those historical curios I really like. So, I believe it was, what year was it? The specific year. It was 1979. It was July 12th, 1979. There was a doubleheader at Comiskey Park in Chicago. And as a promotion to get people in, they had a local radio DJ from the north suburbs who was making a name for himself as a fervent hater of disco. He would talk about how much disco sucked. He would make fun of it all the time on his show. And he was holding the standard for rock. And of course, people talk about how that is, that's all a reactionary, like white supremacist, instinct. It's a revulsion at like the queer blackness of disco. And it's like an expression of that. Probably to a degree. I don't know. So they, one way or another, they decided that they could get people into the stadium by having this dude run a promotion where if you could get in either discounted or for free if you brought a disco record with you to the first game. And then at the moment between the games, they were going to take all those albums that had been collected, put them in a big pile in the middle of the outfield and run them over with a bulldozer. I think like blow them up. They used explosives. And they did it. And it was not a good idea. It was a mistake. Because first of all, everybody who came was essentially insane. Like they were all shit-faced before they got there. They were all wild as hell. And then once the fucking bombs started going off, everyone just lost their shit, and you had this explosion of just libidinal energy. You could just see how if you get people together, and you simmer the crock pot the right way, it could just pop off. And so they ended up having to cancel the second game, and the White Sox forfeited because they couldn't take control of the fucking stadium. Nickel 10-cent beer night was in Cleveland. That's another good one. That one, everyone got so shit-faced that they had to, the Indians had to forfeit the second game in the doubleheader because fans jumped on the field and tried to fight the Royals outfielders or the Rangers outfielders. Oh man, someone wants me to talk about the Loco Focos. The Loco Focos, great name, one of the best names for a political faction in the American history. The 19th century really did have all the best political faction names. You had the Loco Focos, you had the Hunkers and the Barn Burners, you had the Mugwumps, you had the Half-Breeds and the Stalwarts, all very good. So the Loco Focos were a faction of the New York City Democratic Party that was a self-consciously working-class arrangement. They were named that because there had been a meeting of Democrats in New York, and there had been a dispute between the workies, as they were called, the laborers who made up the part of the party, and the regular Democrats. And the workies went into their own hall to have a meeting, and the lights were turned off, like the candles were blown out by the regulars. And then to light the room, the workers pulled out these self-lighting cigars that were popular at the time. You'd like pull them out of the tube, and there would be an internal match, and it would light the thing. And so they pulled out their Locofocos, and they held them up to get the light going. And that's what they were called. And they were the first real self-aware working-class formation within the Democratic Party. But the thing is that they didn't really have any significant effect on or influence of the party because they were so – it was so protean. And the issues – there was still such a unformed conception of like what working class interests were at that time, because there were relatively few urban laborers in the country at that point. And it is one of the things that contributed to America's relatively reactionary politics and failure for any labor party to sustain itself, is that America, because of its ability to trade land for discontent, was able to create mass democracy earlier than Europe was. So that by the time you saw mass working class politics emerge in the late 1800s, it ended up being funneled into the Democratic Party. Whereas in Europe, there had been no mass politics before that point, which meant that the parties that were emerged were self-consciously oriented around and dominated by the workers. Whereas even at the height of their influence within the Democratic Party, like the working class as such was always one element of a coalition and was never the director of a party. And the Locofocos were the first little burst of working class energy around the Democratic Party. The Locofocos. And one of the big Locofoco demands was, at this time, which was dominated by banking as the main domestic issue, as the main political terrain of argument, it was banking. And there was the question of whether you're going to have a national bank, like the Whigs wanted, or you're going to have a system of pet regional banks, or then later an independent treasury, like the Democrats wanted, all the way to, in one way or another, keep the reality of the state's role in creating currency away from politics, which people thought, even at the even regular Americans thought, was freedom. They thought that an independent treasury was somehow possible and would protect their liberty. And sure shit didn't end up happening. But there were a bunch of questions, about how are we going to charter banks? How many banks are going to be allowed to operate? Who is going to decide who allows a bank to be chartered? Because one of the big complaints about the early 19th century banking system is that banks needed to be chartered by states, and those charters were often given to friends of politically influential people, as you would imagine. There's a reason that the Jacksonian network of banks were called pet banks, because they were all parts of the patronage networks around the Democratic Party where the banks existed. And those banks were the sole distributor of paper currency in the country, because there was no national currency at this point. We had gold as the standard, but but there was no national gold-backed currency. Banks would have a certain reserve of gold that they could then lend paper currency out on, essentially. And that is what created the amount of currency that facilitated economic activity. So the battle over the banks really was this battle over who would decide where money is and how much money there would be. But the problem is, from the point of view of working class politics, the actual answer of the state determines it, we should do it collectively and we should do it democratically, was not conceivable. The working men of America, the laborers, believed that the greatest freedom was in the greatest abstraction away from politics of the money supply, which is mystification. But the closest thing that existed, in which the Locofocos insisted upon, was an idea for free banking. And that meant anybody could charter a bank regardless of their relationship with the state. They didn't need to get a charter. Enough people could get together and then they could declare a bank to exist. This was very popular at the high end of the Democratic Party in its elites because powerful people could then get more bank access to credit to create banks because they could access this new system without having to go through the checks, having to make the right right deals, and having to deal with the quotas on banks that were allowed to be chartered. And so the Locofocos thought that the best thing for the working man was to allow everybody to have a fucking bank. And that was like a primitive attempt to articulate a social economy, but just too early. Favorite Elroy novel character? I will always love American Tabloid because it's the first one I read and it blew my mind. And obviously all of his characters are archetypes. So you're really just asking, when you're saying which favorite character, which is your favorite expression of what of your favorite Elroy archetypes? Because you've got the violent but secretly sensitive bruiser, your Bud White, your Pete Bondurant. You've got your smooth operator who's slowly coming apart at the seams, like Jack Vincennes and Kemper Boyd. And then you've got your cowardly nerd who is addicted to his own self-righteousness but is too weak to pursue his own values, like Ward Little or Ed Exley. And I have said before that if you had the BuzzFeed, if there was a BuzzFeed quiz, are you Kemper, Pete, or Ward from American Tabloid? Everybody who is on Twitter would, including myself, would get Ward. So, although I think Pete Bondurant is a huge, just absolute pimp, and I think he's cool. So just from that perspective, my favorite character of his in Cool Points is Pete Bondurant. The one that I relate to the most is, of course, Ward Little. I love the idea that he made him just a fucking Canuck, that he made him a Quebecois. No need. A 7-foot-tall Canuck snapping people's necks. Yeah, definitely. American Tabloid is a great place to start because it's the first book in a trilogy. There's no other stuff that you need to know beforehand. But if you do read them all, and then you run to read the L.A. Quartet, don't do what I did. Because I didn't really know enough about him. I just went to the library and started reading after I read all his other stuff. Is that I read White Jazz before I read any of the other L.A. Quartet, and that was a mistake. Because it really is a cool culmination of a bunch of stuff in L.A. Confidential that didn't hit the way that it would have if I had read at least L.A. Confidential first. So for the love of God, read L.A. Confidential before White Jazz. There's a somebody says they only read American Tabloid. My God, yes, The Cold 6000 and Bloods Are Over. A lot of people don't like Bloods Are Over because it is very different than his other stuff. It's more contemplative and romantic, but I think that as the culmination of that project, it's really fitting, especially since The Cold 6000 is so brutally alienating. The Cold 6000, in part because it's so big and it has so much plot in it. I mean, it's got the, like, American Tabloid is about the lead up to the Kennedy assassination. Cold 6000 features the RFK and Kennedy assassinations in it, and has a whole bunch more characters and stuff. So in order to accommodate that, he essentially just brushed that thing down to every sentence being just object, verb, as few as words as possible. And so it's avant-garde in its terseness. It's a whiplash, but it's very, it's fun. We might get a stagflation again. Who knows? I mean, I didn't want to get into this too much because I don't want to get all like, I don't speculate. I try not to speculate anymore because that's what really got me wound up in the lead up to the election. And then all the stuff after that is having to have an argument, a take that I could really feel like I understood and felt confidence in about the future. So that's why I've been sticking with history. But we have reached the point now, after 2008, where all of the illusions that used to shroud our system, our political economy, are now gone. One of the big reasons that the 2008 collapse happened was that after there were the first few bucklings within the institutions of Wall Street, the first instinct of the powers that be was to not intervene with government money. And that's why Bear Stearns collapsed. That's what started the whole thing to go, the dominoes to fall. And I think we're now at a point where, and I think we saw this with the CARE Act last year, which was just this massive liquidity dump that was on par with what happened in 2008 without any kind of oversight or discussion about it, is that we'll never get another situation where there is any hesitation to just flood the chamber with money. Because I think the reason that there was any kind of fiscal discipline was the worry that, well, if this happens, what if the good money flows somewhere else? What if the circulation is interrupted? And I feel like this current moment right now, where you're seeing these insane escalations of bubbles in every segment of the economy, the creation of new fake simulated things to have bubbles about, like NFTs and crypto, is proof that everyone at every level of control of this structure knows that there is nowhere else for the money to go. That the American dollar and its surrounding investment pools, the American state basically, is the only place for the money to go. It's the hole at the end of it's the hole at the end of the gutter. It's all getting sucked down. So they'll just keep inflating. Everything just has to keep inflating. What's going to pop it? What pops every other bubble was when the money stops coming in, right? In the 19th century, what would happen is that you'd have a big speculative bubble around land, like in the 1830s, or about railroads in the 1870s, and then the Europeans would decide to bring back some of their specie or invest somewhere else, and then boom, boom, you'd have a giant collapse. There's nowhere else for the money to go. Where else is the money supposed to go? People talk about the end of America's reserve currency status, and that would be game over if that happened. but there's nowhere else currently up to the task. So how the fuck does this thing sustain itself? It seems like it shouldn't, but also it keeps doing it and there isn't any alternative. And no one at the top seems that worried about it. But that's the thing. If you're at the top of this system, even if you knew for a fact that all these books are cooked and the end is going to, and this economic structure is going to break down, the supply chain itself is going to break down in the near future, you wouldn't behave any differently than they are right now. Because why the hell would you want to spook the horses, especially when you have already made it so that you know if that does happen, you'll be fine. Internet advertising, thank you. The data is worth nothing. This is a perfect example. So that's a bubble that should pop at some point, right? The data dollar in the Silicon Valley. Because we know now, pretty definitively, that none of that data is worth anything. None of those clicks are worth anything, included in terms of adding value to the companies that pay for them. But it doesn't matter if everybody knows that. If every single person involved in all of these transactions is aware of that, their incentive is still to do it because it's what keeps the fucking tech economy going. It's the only dynamic sector. So we're in a situation where it will continue to go until it collapses because all of the incentives of everyone in a position of power are to keep it going. Because they don't have to actually risk anything. Because you could say, oh no, wouldn't that hurt their investments and stuff? Well, yeah, but they would not be like it would put them in actual danger of losing their position. I mean, if we're not, yeah, oh, they might lose their money, but they won't lose their position. They will have created their own technological bubbles that will allow them to sustain themselves in any eventuality. And if that's the case, if you've got that backstop, then why wouldn't you just keep going through the motions until it bucks up? The only question is, when does it pop? And the thing that keeps fucking with me is, how is it going to pop? Where will the interruption in flow go? Have we created a global system that is now self, it's like fluid karma from Southland Tales, and the very motion itself pulls it forward. It's fucking wild. And yeah, it's like obviously eventually climate change will pop it just in terms of interrupting the resource flow, and then that's the end. That's the wheels will come right off. But that is not going to be a dramatic thing. Is the thing. Climate change effects for the foreseeable future are going to be they're going to be metabolized by the system. Like, disasters cost money, but they also provide speculative investment opportunities. Disaster capitalism always has its creative destructive potential in every failing in every emergent crisis. As long as there is a some sort of equilibrium that can be maintained, it will be. What will happen is that the edges will continue to be eaten away. The edges of what is considered the market, what is considered the political sphere, will be eaten away. There's a story, a horrifying story about that I read about how people in Northern California whose homes were burned down during the big campfire there last year, are still homeless and are now being rousted out of the places that they have set up camp by the police. So these are people who, until a year ago, were solid citizens, taxpayers who were on the inside of the citizenship bubble, people who deserved, people who were part of us, who deserved basic human dignity and access to redress. Their house gets burned down by a fire. They can't get enough. They can't just build another one. They're out of the club. They're now out there homo sacer. bunch of people in southern Louisiana are been that way since that last big hurricane. And I think the dream of the big collapse is the dream where collapse comes fast and hard, and with it at least a glimpse of freedom, at least a glimpse of the ability to a chance to remake your relationship to your world, because all of the restrictions and restraints and demands of life have changed. You get to get closer to the vitality, and you get to fight for yourself and others. Because the alternative is one where you just go from being totally under the command of the system, but also within a pocket of rights and expectations of rights, to being outside of that, but still under the control of systemic power. The thing stays there. It's just the wall moves, and you're on the other side of the wall now. But you're still in the sight line of the fucking cyclopedian panopticon tech drone state. Only now you don't have to. Now you're not being compelled by credit card debt and medical billing. You're being compelled by a fucking a drone hovering over your head telling you to move on. So this is why I said why I want to read something that confronts this moment and imagines a way out. Because we all have to imagine a way out for ourselves, if not for the world. And I don't mean transcending the problems. I mean transcending our soul sickness at the scale of the problems. Transcending our paralysis in the face of the problems. The numbers are off here. Weird. Let me check this. All right, I'm going to wrap up here in a minute. Maybe answer a couple questions. Yes, we need Marianne Williamson. No, Marianne Williamson and Jesse Ventura. That's what we need. No, that's. I think we're past politics, honestly. Man, like, it feels like everything is really simmering, though. Like, Israel, that's intense. And then Colombia, I mean, it's been just one rolling crisis everywhere. And even, obviously, here, last summer. But it still has this horrible stasis to it. I think the thing that is so alienating and terrifying and bewildering about the moment is that everything feels fully liquefied, but also totally overdetermined. And I feel like that's the 70s too. Like, oh my God, nothing is working. Every structure is leading us towards oblivion, and yet none of them seem to actually be losing their power over us. And so that really gives you the sensation of being locked in an airplane where the pilot has jumped out and you're on course to hit a fucking mountain. And then you just have to spend your time trying to come to terms with what's going to come. Unless you figure out a way to get in the goddamn cockpit and get a goddamn one of the things and call someone at air traffic control and talk your way out of it. Yeah, I saw the fucking Ned Lamont. God, what a name. A blast from the past. The guy who was like the Netroots candidate who was going to, who beat Joe Lieberman for the Senate seat in Connecticut, and then was beaten by Joe Lieberman when Joe Lieberman ran on a third party, like, independent Joe Lieberman party ticket with the support of, I think, a majority of Republicans in Connecticut ended up voting for him, which is how he got back in. And then Ned Lamont ended up running for governor, a year or two ago, and now he's Grover Clevelanding it, throwing out the National Guard to stop a nursing home strike. It is interesting. There's a lot of people who have theories about the care economy being the next real main front of the labor of the labor movement and workers' struggle. I mean, we'll see. This is a good, if it gets stamped out by this fucking geek, this easily, we'll see. Who knows? Don't know yet. I'm imagining just like the troops from like the crazies just coming into a nursing home with their fucking M16s and stealing people's medicine, just getting robo tripping in the infirmary. I don't actually know what robo tripping is. Is that about taking Robitussin? I don't know. Holding your breath. It would be really funny if Biden just cured cancer though in the middle of all this. Like Biden just comes out and goes, guys, cancer's done. What if it was a vaccine though? What if there was a cancer cure? All cancers cured. Obviously, this is impossible. I'm saying what if? Cancer's cured, but it's a vaccine. I kind of think a lot of anti-vaxxers would cave just because of how scary cancer is. Cuba has a lung cancer vaccine, but once again, it's for like specific types. Like there is no overall cancer cure. Although, I don't know. I got to think that there has to be some genetic thing you could do, some switch you could turn off. Yeah, what if you just injected yourself with like shark sperm or something? Those guys don't get cancer. If I learned anything from Deep Blue Sea, it's that sharks don't get cancer or Alzheimer's. Should you rewatch Deep Blue Sea? Always. It's a classic for a reason. Okay, folks. Talk to you probably on Friday. And then next Wednesday, we'll talk about the first three chapters of the Cool Book. Just be wrapping up about the many bungles of the SDP and Frederick Ebert, who we all got to give two big thumbs down to. All right. Bye-bye.